highs in the low teens. Thanks for choosing KAXE this morning. There is more ahead from Morning Edition.
Good morning. A U.S. official says Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth gave the commands to repeatedly strike a boat in the Caribbean. The top Democrat on the House Armed Services Committee shares what questions he'll be asking on Morning Edition from NPR News. A volunteer who worked with the man accused of shooting two National Guard members did not see signs of radicalization. I'm Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel. The volunteer says people tried to get him mental health support as he appeared to unravel. Also, Pope Leo XIV holds a huge mass on the Beirut waterfront. And we hear from the new artistic director of the Alvin Ailey Dance Theater on mixing tradition with something new. It's Tuesday, December 2nd. On this day in 1982, doctors implanted a permanent artificial heart for the first time. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Trump's envoy, Steve Witkoff, is expected in Moscow today for talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin. The Kremlin says they'll be joined by Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. NPR's Charles Means reports they'll discuss the latest U.S. plan for ending the war in Ukraine.
This is the sixth time Witkoff has met in person with Putin since President Trump tasked him with resolving the Ukraine crisis back in January. This time, the billionaire businessman turned presidential envoy comes bearing a new draft peace plan, one initially criticized for being overly favorable to Russia and since revised with input from Ukraine and its European allies. It remains unclear whether Putin will accept those changes. In comments last week, Putin said he remained open to the U.S. proposal in theory, but the Kremlin leader also conditioned any lasting peace on Ukraine withdrawing from territory claimed but not controlled by Moscow, despite more than 3 years of heavy fighting. Charles Maines, NPR News, Moscow.
The Afghan man accused of shooting two National Guard soldiers in Washington, D.C. last week appeared to suffer a personal crisis before the attack. That's according to a refugee resettlement volunteer who worked closely with Rahmanullah Lakhanwal over a period of years. NPR's Brian Mann reports.
The volunteer who worked with Lakhanwal in Bellingham, Washington, spoke with NPR on condition of anonymity because they said they feared for their safety. When they first worked with Lakhanwal in 2022, he appeared hopeful and outgoing. But by 2023, his condition appeared to worsen as he struggled to find steady work. My biggest concern was that he would harm himself, the volunteer said. I worried he would be suicidal. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem said Sunday Lakhanwal appeared to be radicalized after coming to the U.S. from Afghanistan. But the volunteer who worked with Lakhanwal and his family said there was no sign of that. They described an individual who seemed to be experiencing a deepening personal crisis. Brian Mann, NPR News.
Arizona Democratic Senator Mark Kelly is condemning President Trump as a bully. Kelly says Trump was wrong to criticize Kelly and other lawmakers for producing a video. It told U.S. military members not to obey illegal orders. Kelly is a retired Navy captain. Artificial intelligence now touches the lives of many people. NPR's Barbara Sprunt reports a nonprofit hopes to harness the power of AI to help elect independent candidates to Congress next year.
It's been 35 years since a new independent candidate won a House seat, but the Independence Center wants to change that. The nonprofit is using AI to find congressional districts where voters are fed up with both parties. Strategists say they've identified 40 districts like that where independents could break through. The center plans on backing about a dozen candidates in the midterms next year, and with the extremely narrow balance of power in the House, just a handful of independents could prevent either party from getting a majority. Barbara Sprunt, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News. New research suggests the brain's wiring goes through five distinct stages over a person's lifetime. NPR's John Hamilton has more on a study that appears in the journal Nature Communication.
Researchers at the University of Cambridge in the UK studied the brains of more than 3,800 people from newly born to age 90. The team used MRI to see how the brain's wiring changed over that span, and they identified four time points when the brain reconfigures. At about age 9, the brain ends its childhood phase, which prunes away unneeded connections between neurons. It also begins an adolescent phase of optimizing the connections that remain. At 32, the brain enters a long period of stability. Then, around age 66, connections start to weaken, a process that accelerates after age 83. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Several countries in South and Southeast Asia continue to reel from nearly a week of weather catastrophes. These were triggered by tropical storms. Some news reports say at least 1,200 people have been killed in flooding and landslides. The flooding has hit Sri Lanka, Vietnam, Thailand, and Malaysia. Hundreds of victims have also perished in Indonesia. In the U.S., the National Weather Service says more than 55 million people are under winter storm warnings or winter weather advisories this morning. A wintry system is barreling east. Parts of the Midwest and the Mid-Atlantic will get several inches of snow. There are winter storm warnings posted up to New England. Forecasters say parts of that region could get up to a foot of snow. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at Cigna.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's the people of northern Minnesota that power KAXE.
I'm a member because I feel a sense of belonging being part of KAXE, because I know that they are representing me and the communities and people in our area and the work that we're doing in such a truthful and honest way. I love being able to share it nationally and tell people I've met across the nation, like, you can understand more about what it's like to live in northern Minnesota by listening online. There's so much that is of value to people anywhere. It's just an honor to contribute and be part of it.
Help us out. Tell us why you are a member. Text us at 218-326-1234 and keep KAXE powered. We're independent, we're local, we're not run by corporations, the government, or a national network. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. President Trump and his advisors met yesterday evening to discuss next steps with Venezuela.
The meeting comes amid growing tension between the two countries. For months, the Trump administration has conducted deadly strikes against what it claims are drug boats traveling from Venezuela to the U.S., and there's a military buildup off the coast of Venezuela. Coming up, we'll speak with Representative Adam Smith about questions he has over the legality of the attacks. Let's first get to the latest facts.
NPR White House correspondent Danielle Kurtzleben is here. So, Danielle, tell us about the meeting over Venezuela.
Well, there's not much to tell right now. We do know the meeting had been set to be with Trump's national security team, so that would include people like Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, Secretary of State Marco Rubio. But Trump has said he spoke to Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro last week. But Trump wouldn't say much more. All that said, it was likely not a friendly call. Trump has long railed against the authoritarian leader. And Maduro, for his part, thinks the U.S. is aiming for regime change in his country. And he's accused the U.S. of using this pretext of fighting drug traffickers to seize his country's oil reserves.
Now, you mentioned Secretary Pete Hegseth in connection to that meeting about Venezuela. He's getting some heat for strikes on one of those boats. Take us through why.
Sure. So on Friday, the Washington Post reported that on September 2nd, U.S. forces struck one of those boats, leaving survivors afterwards. And so Hegseth gave an order to kill those survivors. Now, NPR later confirmed that Hegseth had ordered both strikes. All of that matters because, as Congress members from both parties have said, that second strike may have constituted a war crime. Meanwhile, the Department of Defense in that Washington Post story said that, quote, this entire narrative is completely false.
Now, what did we learn from the White House yesterday?
Well, the administration then confirmed some parts of this story. At yesterday's press briefing, Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt acknowledged a second strike. But as for Hegseth ordering it, she didn't deny it, but said Hegseth authorized U.S. Navy Admiral Frank M. Bradley to take these actions.
Secretary Hegseth authorized Admiral Bradley to conduct these kinetic strikes. Admiral Bradley worked well within his authority and the law, directing the engagement to ensure the boat was destroyed and the threat to the United States of America was eliminated.
But our NPR colleague Tom Bowman has new reporting on this. Yesterday, a U.S. official who was not authorized to speak publicly pushed back on the White House, saying Hegseth gave the command for two strikes to kill in addition to two strikes to sink the boat.
Okay, so we have all that. And just a few weeks ago, Democratic Congress members with military or intelligence backgrounds released a video telling service members to refuse illegal orders. Trump called that video seditious behavior, punishable by death. Have they responded to the latest developments?
Yes, Arizona Democratic Senator Mark Kelly, a retired naval officer who was in that video, spoke about this yesterday. When a reporter asked him about the strikes, Kelly said if the reporting is accurate, that second strike could have been illegal.
I will say, though, you know, as somebody who has sunk two ships myself, folks in the military need to understand the law of the sea, the Geneva Conventions, what the law says.
And leaders of the Senate and House Armed Services Committees have said they're going to be looking into these strikes. And Admiral Bradley is expected to give a classified briefing on Thursday. So we may know more about them in the weeks ahead.
All right. That's NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Let's go now to one of those lawmakers scrutinizing that September 2nd attack on a boat in the Caribbean. Representative Adam Smith of Washington is the top-ranking Democrat on the House Armed Services Committee, which oversees the U.S. military. Good morning, Congressman, and thank you for being on the program.
Well, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Last week, you released a joint statement with the Republican Committee Chair Mike Rogers saying that you'd be, quote, taking bipartisan action to gather a full accounting of the operation in question. What are you planning to ask for? What does a full accounting look like?
Well, first up, on this specific strike, but it goes beyond the specific strike, as your reporting point out. What happened? Would you release the video, first of all? Second of all, any documents about what happened on the strike? Who ordered it? And what were the rules of engagement going into it? And who made the specific order? So on that strike, that's what we want to find out. But this goes beyond the strike. I mean, what's the legality of the strikes in general? Because the law of war that we keep referring to has to do with going after enemy combatants who pose a threat to you. Now, the argument on this one is the ship was basically sinking. Two people were clinging to the side of it. No argument. Those two people presented a strike. But presented a threat. But what threat did the boat itself present even before that, or any of the boats that we struck?
Well, let's break this down a little bit. What's the difference about this second strike that killed survivors clinging to a boat? That is the accusation, right? Pete Hegseth, the defense secretary, denies ordering these people to be killed versus the dozens of other people that have been killed and the first strike.
Yeah, the difference, once that's straightforward, is the boat was disabled. The people in question were clearly disabled. They were, clinging to a side of the boat in the middle of the ocean.
Yeah.
All right. Now, you can argue, okay, before that, they were perfectly healthy on a boat that was moving. It could much more conceivably be a threat in that sense. But again, you take that a little bit further, a threat in what sense? I mean, they were trafficking cocaine. They had no intention whatsoever of directly, in any sort of military sense, attacking the United States or any American before that. So what I hope is, yes, we are going to look into this specific strike, but we have to do much more than that.
We'll look into
the entire campaign in terms of what's going on. And also, let's ask the question, to your point on Venezuela, what's really going on here? Is this really about drugs, or is this about trying to take down Venezuela and maybe even putting pressure on Petro and Colombia as well? And if so, that's an entirely different thing than saying you're doing this because of a drug problem in America.
So will this bipartisan action then be a much wider investigation than this one strike? Is that the plan?
That's my plan. I don't know yet. And let's keep in mind that the really interesting part about this is the Republican chairman, Mike Rogers, and the chairman of the Senate, Roger Wicker. They're both all in for this investigation on this strike. We're hoping to widen that. And there has been considerable bipartisan frustration in the House and the Senate about the lack of transparency from the Trump administration, both about the boat strikes themselves, but then also about the larger plans around Venezuela. I'm going to push very hard to get us to look into do all of that. But we're going to have to, you know, get the majority to go along with us on some of those things.
Congressman, a U.S. official, as we heard, told NPR that Hegseth gave the command for two strikes to kill on that particular boat that we're discussing, in addition to two strikes to sink the boat. But Hegseth has denied ordering the survivors be killed. So if this is true, who's ultimately responsible? The admiral who carried out the order, Frank M. Bradley, or the defense secretary?
Well, there's a chain of responsibility here. President Trump is ultimately responsible. He ordered it and allowed the operation to go forward. Secretary Hegseth is certainly responsible. But then to the point of the video those six lawmakers put out, you know, the UCMJ is very clear on this point. You do not have to carry out illegal orders, and if you do, you're potentially liable yourself. So the whole chain of command is liable, but please understand what happened yesterday. I mean, Leavitt frequently will just answer questions, go back and forth. You know, it's very sort of spontaneous and ad hoc to some degree. She specifically read that statement. It was pre-prepared, ready to go, word for word.
And you're referring to Caroline Leavitt, the spokesperson for the White House.
Yeah, it was a CYA moment for Hegseth, which is really, truly pathetic. He's the Secretary of Defense. He's been running around talking about how tough he is and how he's going to do this, he's going to do that. And the second something goes south, he's like, hey, wasn't me. It was that guy over there. He did the order. So I think that was a really sad thing. And one of the things that, one of many things that this administration has done to the disservice of the men and women serving in our military. You know, he's putting them in a terrible spot by giving them these highly questionable orders. And then after that, to come out and say, hey, it was that guy, not me, that's not leadership. And it's also not honest. It seems to me Secretary Hegseth is the one who's responsible for what happened here.
The White House is saying the strike was legally justified, although we have heard the president distance himself from the second strike. What legal terms would you use to define the strikes to kill and why?
Yeah, well, first of all, let's focus in on that point for a moment. They say it's legal, and yet they went to great pains to make sure that Hegseth wasn't the one who gave the order. So obviously, they're a little nervous about that point. Look, the legal terms are straightforward. And look, it's interesting. I was on Rachel Maddow last night, and the textbook talking about illegal orders mentions an example of striking survivors on a sinking ship. Okay, so it seems like it is against the law of war. I mean, people throw out the phrase war crime all the time. I mean, war is a hellish experience in which very difficult things happen and people have to make tough decisions. But it seems clear that based on what happened here, if the facts are as described, this is a clear violation both of U.S. law about how to conduct yourself in a war and also international law. And again, the other interesting thing about this, the whole operation, is this a war? You know, the Trump administration spends half their time saying no, which is why they haven't waited for congressional authorization or even followed the War Powers Resolution. This memo that's out there to explaining the legal justification for this is fascinating because half of it says this is why this is an armed conflict, why these narco-terrorist groups are such a threat, they're doing all these awful things. And the other half says, no, it's not a war, so therefore we don't have to get permission from Congress.
Well, so coming back to the investigation or the look into this, are you going to have Secretary Hegseth and Admiral Bradley appear before the committee? And do you expect the White House to cooperate?
I do not expect the White House to cooperate. And yeah, we're going to push for all that. One of the challenges here, there's a lot of classified information in this discussion. We're meeting with Admiral Bradley this week. It's going to be classified. We're trying to get a full committee hearing next week classified. I think there also ought to be a public hearing. But all up and down the chain of command, we're going to try to get everybody we can to come in and tell us what happened.
Representative Adam Smith is a top Democrat on the House Armed Services Committee. And we'll note that we invited a number of your Republican colleagues to discuss this. The offer still stands. Thank you for your time, Congressman.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
It is 6:19. Thanks for listening to the Tuesday Morning Show here on People Powered KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up, National Native News at 6:30. Heidi Holton and John Latimer, your hosts. And we'll have some student phonology talkbacks and also John Latimer's latest phonology report at 7:20. Support comes from Brainstorm Bakery, headquarters of Crapola, with four flavors of granola handcrafted at the bakery on East Sheridan Street in Ely. Online ordering available and more at brainstormbakery.com. Weather today, mostly cloudy, highs 19 to 22, chance of light snow this afternoon and this evening, southwest winds up to 15 miles per hour. Lows tonight in the single digits and partly to mostly sunny tomorrow with highs in the low teens. Looking ahead to Thursday, slight chance of snow in the afternoon, mostly cloudy with highs near 13. Support for KAXE comes from Woodworks Homes, dedicated to the art of building in northern Minnesota by constructing handcrafted new homes and offering remodeling services. More at woodworksmn.com. There is a sensory-friendly Santa event December 4th through the 6th at Northland Arboretum in Baxter. You can register for a 15-minute time slot and learn more at northlandarb.org. Click on Events. We continue now with Morning Edition on KAXC.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Sony Pictures Classics, presenting Merrily We Roll Along, a new cinematic interpretation of the Stephen Sondheim musical, starring Jonathan Groff, Daniel Radcliffe, and Lindsay Mendez, in movie theaters starting December 5th. From Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at melvilletrust.org. From Bayer, Bayer is dedicated to delivering breakthroughs that save lives and feed the world using the scientific process. Learn more at sciencedelivers.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
I'm Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Amid the ferment of the civil rights movement, Alvin Ailey founded the dance company that bears his name to uplift and showcase African-American culture. Nearly seven decades later, it's produced signature works that have been acclaimed around the world, formed generations of new dancers through its school, and developed an expansive and inclusive repertoire, building bridges with music, visual arts, and the written word. Tomorrow, the company launches its first season under Alicia Graf Mack, a former principal dancer with the company.
So there are over 1,000 dancers in our school, from the little ones to the little professionals.
And 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and up.
She gave me a sneak peek of the new season at Ailey's New York studios.
Good morning.
Good. Big change, but actually not such a big change because you are a principal dancer here at Alvin Ailey. When you were dancing, did you ever think I might be artistic director one day?
No. This stage of my life is such a surprise and a blessing. I was so lucky to have Judith Jamison as the blueprint or the North Star for all the possibilities in the arts.
Who had also been a principal dancer.
And someone that I looked up to literally since I was a child, having a poster of her in my childhood bedroom. What she did to create a company that is a cultural ambassador of American and Black culture is incredible.
The last time we met, you were dean and director of the dance division at Juilliard, a premier artistic educational organization. You're only, what, the fourth artistic director of this company?
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of...
It's amazing and daunting. As we sit here, we're sitting at Mr. Ailey's desk. Mm-hmm. So every time I come into this office, I'm, lifted by the founding angels of this institution. Behind you is Ms. Jamison's chaise lounge. I feel her with me all the time. She became a mentor after I was a dancer, another mother figure to me. And of course, Robert Battle was an incredible director to work under. I learned so much under him, and he remains a great friend.
So let's dive into the new season. Mm-hmm. It kicks off in New York in early December before you go on tour across the U.S. There will be five world premieres.
That's right.
Could you describe, like, what was your vision for this season?
I hope that when audience members come to see the season, that they feel a fresh energy, that it is the same Ailey, powerful, visceral, connected to spirit and humanity.
It's interesting because people are very loyal to this company. Audiences mm-hmm. are very loyal to yes. this company, right? And many performances end with revelations, which is a signature piece, mm. but the art form itself requires change. Yes. How do you think about that?
There's always something, an honored tradition, and then something new. And that's how we move forward. When people come to see revelations, they are expecting to be transformed. And that's why they come. It's like going to church.
But one thing that is going to be different on the Washington, D.C. stop is that you won't be performing at the Kennedy Center.
That's
like
right.
A number of arts organizations, including a planned stop of Hamilton, they've pulled out of planned performances at the Kennedy Center. You will be performing at the Warner Theater. What went into that decision?
We felt that it was necessary to find a venue where everyone felt welcome to come and experience the magic of Ailey.
It's a smaller venue, though, so
yes.
I'm assuming that you had to make some adaptations.
Well, we will be there over 2 weeks. So although the capacity of the theater is smaller than at the Kennedy Center, we'll have several performances to welcome people to.
I was just wondering, is there something different about preparing artists in this moment?
As artists, it is our responsibility to tell stories. It is our responsibility to be the keepers of the culture. I'm always aiming to uplift, to encourage and inspire the dancers to be able to be truth tellers on the stage.
There were artists who were performing at a theatrical production that the president and members of his administration are known to enjoy, mm-hmm. and some members of the performing company didn't want to perform. And I don't know whether that is a challenge that might present itself, but if it did, what would you do?
There will not be any changes or censorship or anything of that nature. We will present ourselves as authentically as possible, and we never want to present ourselves in a way that excludes anyone.
Ellen Ailey once said, the most unique thing in the world is you. And I'm wondering how you translate that in this moment to your leadership of this organization.
I feel that deeply, even for myself. It gives me confidence to move forward. It's very easy kind of just to stand on a hill at the top of everything and look down, but the work is to be in the studios, be in the theaters.
Up and cross, 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 down.
To
up,
teach the community up, outreach classes, to teach the kids in the school, and the idea that the arts should be lifted and supported, and that really is one of the only ways that we can see our young people establish their self-worth and their self-esteem. So I try to always reach back to, again, Mr. Ailey's values and guiding principles of lifting people through the arts.
That is Alicia Graf Mack. She is the new artistic director of the Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater. Congratulations as the season begins. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
This is NPR News.
In a one-mile stretch of Houston, a Hindu temple, Vietnamese Buddhist center, a church, and a mosque all call each other neighbor.
That's what the United States is. You know, we're a melting pot of a whole lot of different nationalities and different religions, etc. And I think that this is just a microcosm of that.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. How the Union Corridor presents a snapshot of interfaith harmony in Texas on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered. It's coming up this afternoon at 4 o'clock here on People Powered KAXE. It is almost 6:30. I'm Heidi Holton. That's John Latimer.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
How are you doing?
I'm good.
There's ice on your lake.
Yes, there is. And there's snow and there's an X right in front of our house. We don't understand.
I saw you had a big X marks the spot.
If it wasn't this time of year, I would think it was just a vehicle had gone through there
and plowed it
somehow, made an axe. I don't know.
Wide would you say it? You sent me a picture.
Yeah.
It's got to be 10 or 15 feet wide.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, and then we can see there's some of that over on the, down the shoreline a little mm-hmm. bit too. So it's not just in front of us, but we've never seen that. I don't know. I mean, it would seem weird that the wind could be specific to the X.
I don't think so.
Is it current?
I think the ice cracked and water came up through the ice and sort of melted or soaked the snow and made it dark. It just happened that two cracks intersected at nearly 90 degrees to one another. That's what it looks like to me.
We're just special. That's all.
Yeah. Yeah,
I hope. Indeed. I hope not being.
And you say there's like 3 inches.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that'll hold a body.
Yeah, yeah.
Although if you're thinking about going out skating, and believe me, I am, you're going to want to have. I like to have a life jacket that inflates when it hits the water. I like to have picks so that I can dig myself out when I go through, and I have. And I like to let people know that I'm going out and where, so that if I don't show up at scheduled appointments later on in the day, people can come look for me. So just, you know, take some precautions, use your head and be cautious.
Yep. And give it time. Give it some time. Sounds like you're acquainted with these things of needing the
I have gotten wet. Yep. I've both have just broken through on shore trying to get out on ice. Mm-hmm. And I have broken through out on the lake and dug myself out, as many of you have. And it sort of focuses your attention when you go through to right now what's in front of me and what can I do to get back out of this cold water. And the best thing you can do is stay calm, turn around. If you were skating along and you break through, the ice that you were skating on just prior to breaking through was holding you up. So turn around 180 degrees and go back the way you came. Because you don't know what's out in front of you. That may be thinner and thinner ice. So 180 degrees and head back the way you came before you start trying to work yourself out. And if you're going out with friends, you know, take 25 feet of rope with you. It doesn't hurt, and you can leave it sitting on shore. You'll have time to skate over and get it and come back and throw it in there and drag that person back up onto ice again.
Well, I'm just going to be the voice of reason. Maybe wait a while. That's what a lot of people are nervous. Someone's hearing this and is going to go do this, John. And you are experienced, but a lot of people aren't. So
yeah, well, if it's your first day out, you know, wait a while.
Yeah.
Just put it off. Wait till you see me out there.
That's right.
If you can see me skating around out there and I look like I'm having a pretty good time and not wet, you might want to come out and join me. I'm always happy to have somebody skating with me.
I have been skiing a couple times. We did little trails in our woods, so that's been nice to be out there. It's gorgeous.
I have not skied. I went out on Thanksgiving. I went out the day before Thanksgiving and cut some Christmas trees and took them down to the cities. I had a very pleasurable ride to the cities with a couple of balsams in the back. Kind of made the car like having an air freshener
in there.
That was quite nice.
Not a fake one hanging from
the... No, not a fake one. This one was obscuring my vision out the back. They were obscuring my vision. And I had probably an 11-foot birch tree in there, too. My daughter likes birch trees for her Christmas.
Nice.
So I had to tie a rope around the top of the birch tree and sort of reel it in, twist it back into the car. But birch is pretty flexible, which is both to its credit and to its detriment. We haven't had an ice storm yet this winter, and we may not get one. But if we do, you can be assured that the birch will collect the water on its branches and then bend over. And sometimes it will straighten up and sometimes it will break off. But birches just have that limber nature to them. And their architecture sort of encourages water to flow out to the ends of the branches where it will then freeze and add weight to the tree. And that piles up and gets heavier and heavier. And pretty soon the tree just bends over. And lots of bent over birches. Robert Frost wrote about them.
Mm. Coming up next, we've got National Native News. We're going to learn about how several Southwest Alaska communities had one night of hurricane-force winds and floods that have destroyed what has taken years to rebuild. So stay tuned for that story. And then we've got some student phonology talkbacks.
Good. We receive support from Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community featuring live music multiple times a week, farm-fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu available at rapidsbrewingco.com.
Here's the weather today. Chance of flurries early, then snow this afternoon, mostly cloudy with highs 19 to 23, south winds 5 to 15. Chance of snow and cloudy tonight, lows 1 to 7 with blustery south winds 5 to 15. And partly to mostly sunny tomorrow, highs 4 to 13, and then evening lows 7 to 12 below zero.
Ooh.
Uh-huh.
Minus temperatures.
Mm-hmm. First ones I've seen.
I had my first single digit temperatures yesterday morning. It was 5 degrees at my house.
Yeah.
First time I've been below 10. Mm. Support comes from the Loft Event Center in downtown Bemidji, providing a multi-purpose event space that accommodates groups of all sizes up to 150 people for wedding receptions, business meetings, concerts, and more. Info about the Loft Event Center, rates, and packages at BemidjiLodge.com.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. For several Southwest Alaska communities, it took one night of hurricane-force winds and floods to destroy what could take years to rebuild. How and where to begin is a question that a group of men from Kipnuk tackled at a construction workshop in Anchorage. They've been staying in the city since their village was evacuated after the October storm. But as KMBA's Rhonda McBride found out, this time, instead of disaster, it was an opportunity that came knocking.
The whack of a hammer. The buzz of the saw. Those are the sounds of hope.
3 3/8 larger and 3 3/8 smaller.
They just lost their homes. They lost everything.
Tiffany Caudill is the training coordinator for Alaska Works Partnership, which offered a one-week program on how to frame a house.
I do think that this is really helping them stay positive and stay hopeful. They've all been so grateful for this training.
And they're all volunteers, like Devin Mann.
This is the door, and this one's going to be the window.
Devin looks sharp in a brand new hoodie given to him after a military cargo plane airlifted him and almost his entire community to Anchorage. He came with only the clothing he had on and feelings of trauma after a 5-mile ride in a floating house.
I thought something bad was going to happen to the house, like break apart. I thought that would be it for us, but I almost gave up. I had hope. I had hope.
It is hope that keeps Devin going.
Everything we're learning in here and doing, it's going to be useful in the future for our village.
I mean, honestly, I can't stress it enough. Use your wrists.
William Andrew is impressed with his crew of trainees.
For what they went through, I'll be honest with you, their attitudes are awesome. They're wanting to learn. They've been great.
Andrew says 1 week of training in basic construction skills is not enough to learn how to rebuild a village, but it's a start.
I'm excited about their future, and I'm hoping that they get to rebuild it.
For now, there are hopes the training will lead to jobs and other opportunities. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
5 Native people are among 29 Bush Fellows to receive awards to develop leadership skills. In the 4th of 5 profiles, Brian Bull of Buffalo's Fire reports on a tribal judge who wants to indigenize the bench.
Since childhood, Megan Troyer has been fascinated by the judicial system and concerned with making sure Native people receive fair and equitable treatment under the law. The daughter of a White Earth Ojibwe tribal judge and an Austrian Holocaust survivor, Troyer serves as chief judge for the Boys Fort Band of Ojibwe. She has very specific goals for her Bush Fellowship.
I'm going to cut my judicial caseload in half and take Ojibwe courses for the 2 years of the fellowship. And I'm really going to make focusing on the language my top priority and try to learn as much as I possibly can. And then part of my fellowship will be going around to Indigenous scholars, spiritual leaders, and mentors that have worked in the area of.
Ultimately, Troyer says she wants to bring humanity to the judicial system. Her late mother, Margaret Troyer, was the second Native American attorney in Minnesota and was appointed as a federal magistrate in 1982, making the elder Troyer the first female Native judge in the country. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kiwanek Broadcast Corporation with funding in part by the Annenberg Foundation and the Ford Foundation. Thanks for tuning in. This is the Tuesday morning show. It's People Powered, KAXE. It's December 2nd already, and there are lots of things going on throughout our region. Sometimes it's only on the weekends, but today there's lots of things. Like, you could try out, John, for Fiddler on the Roof.
Except that I can't sing or act.
Well, there's that, but you could.
I could.
It's 6 to 9 o'clock.
That's true.
Tonight, yeah. At the Rife Center, Grand Rapids players are putting on the auditions. And then there is also Hope for the Holidays, a free event. Helps people understand grief and cope with loss during this time of year. It is at 1 p.m. at the Teresa Room at St. Joseph's Medical Center in Brainerd. And Bemidji Symphony Orchestra has their holiday favorites. That's tonight at 7 at Bemidji High School Auditorium. The concert will end with a sing-along. So I guess you can't go to that one either.
Well, I could go, but I would be better. Those around me would appreciate it if I would just mouth the words. I'm not a singer. No, I you could sing a note and I would have no chance of duplicating it. I can't hear or recreate sounds that, you know, people would associate with singing. I can hear and recreate sounds, but most of them people would associate with pain or shock and surprise or
Do you ever sing along to things?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, I don't.
Have you been told at some point to not sing out loud?
I was.
Okay.
But it's right. Been long, long, long repressed. It was, I was in grade school. I was in fourth grade.
I feel a hurt here.
Not actually. I was pretty relieved. I knew that I couldn't sing at an early age and I just would fake it or try not to sing too loud because I just couldn't make a noise that, you know, blended. I made noises that didn't blend, that kind of upset people. Those people who have, you know, like an ear for music.
Right.
Yeah, it's all right, though. You know, I love to dance, so I got that. Anyway, I got a sense of rhythm. I just can't sing, and that's okay. They're, you know, you look at a band, they need people to play instruments that maybe don't help sing. So there's hope, but, you know, I'm getting to an age where I'm not sure I'm going to take up a musical instrument and join a band.
Yeah, I like that you're leaving it open, though.
Oh,
yeah. You never know.
You know, there's always the possibility.
Well, and there is an artistic opportunity as well. Artist Nelia Harper French invites you to the attic in the Old Central School in Grand Rapids to make an ornament. It's all this week. Hours are noon to four. You can just walk in.
Huh.
All the materials will be provided.
Hmm. So
there's something going on as well. And Clearwater County Historical Society has their Festival of Trees, and that starts today. You can enjoy more than 30 trees. Vote for your favorite. Donations of non-perishable food items are encouraged. Special events are happening each weekend through December 21st.
This is the season for sure. Yeah, and if you're thinking about, you know, what am I going to buy my kids for Christmas? Well, they no doubt want games and things like that that go on computers because that's where the world has gone. But, you know, I would recommend getting a kid a hand lens. There are thousands of books out there that are truly full of great information, great pictures, great enthusiasm to get people directed into nature. And of course, that's where my interest lies. So if you're on my Christmas list, don't expect, you know, Jane of Wuthering Heights. You're likely to get something by Bernd Heinrich.
So we're kind of starting that conversation. We're working on that behind the scenes. We'll have some gift recommendations from the staff of KXC, including John Latimer. And coming up at 7:45, we are learning from the folks that put on the Practical Water Wisdom webinar series. They have one coming up this Thursday at noon, and it is Water Wishes for the Holidays. So we are going to talk with John Downing and Hillary Sorensen, and they are giving us ideas for water and lake-themed children's books to explore at home for gifts.
Perfect.
Yeah, so we'll start that. And you are always welcome to join our conversation. You can text us at 218-326-1234.
Support for KAXE comes from Lady Sippers N.A. Bottle Shop, located in downtown Deer River. Itasca County's only N.A. bottle shop, offering ready-to-drink options, ingredients for craft cocktails, gifts, and more. Info available at ladysippers.com. And we receive support from Beltrami Electric, building an all-of-the-above energy strategy that combines the diverse strengths of sun, wind, solar, coal, and water. Beltrami Electric Cooperative, connecting communities and powering life in northern Minnesota for more than 80 years.
Coming up next, we will have our Phenology Talkback segment, and at 7:20, John brings us the full Phenology report. We are really excited. We've been having people respond to the Season Watch podcast that goes out every week. We've got a portion of the Phenology report. We've got kids' reports and then calls that people have made to us and questions that they have out there. So we might hear one of those today and see what you have to think about that. And then you'll hear Season Watch. You hear it on the weekends, or you can sign up through it. For it through a podcast that's coming out on Thursday.
It is then time for our talkback segment. And our talkbacks, of course, are funded in part by the
Minnesota Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. This week, Phenology Talkbacks produced by Charlie Mitchell and me.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, and thank Charlie. Our first report comes from Underwood Elementary's trip to the Long Lake Conservation Center near Palisade.
Hi, this is Cambria.
And Justice from Underwood Elementary. Our trip to Long Lake Conservation Center on November 24th through the 26th was a tale of two seasons. When we arrived on Monday, the temperature was a sunny 54 degrees. By Wednesday, large snowflakes started falling at noon, and the temperature dropped to 19. We measured the snow this morning. It was between 6 and 7 inches. On Monday, the bog was green and the water wasn't frozen in the pitcher plates. We spotted a garter snake on the trail soaking up the sun. We knew the snow and cold was coming, so we moved it near the entrance of the hibernaculum. Hopefully he is safe and sound with his friends. Later in the woods, we saw a wood frog jumping in the leaves looking for a place to hibernate. After the snow, we noticed lots of fresh deer and other animal tracks. This was Miss Ann's 30th trip to Long Lake with our school. We had a great time exploring nature with her and wanted to remind everyone to unplug, get outside, and live connected.
Well, thank you, Cambria and Justice. That was a nice report. Lots of good things going on there. And indeed it was. You may recall, pardon me, a week ago yesterday, sunny temperatures in the 50s. It was beginning to look like, oh my gosh, we're just going to not have winter. But Thanksgiving came and slapped us into our good senses. And we got plenty of cold temperatures and plenty of snow. I had 5 inches at my house. Then the depth of the snow decreased as you went north and east of here. But Bob Konzemius, our meteorologist, had kind of predicted that the snow was going to be more intense south and a little bit east of us. And it was over in the south of Duluth and into Wisconsin where they really got the deep wood, deep snow. But 6 to 7 inches in Palisade, that's a pretty good group. I had 5 inches at my house. It melted out to, I think, 0.65 inches of rain, so it was pretty wet. Heavy snow, not super heavy, but noticeable. It was, it was a good, strong way to start the snow shoveling season. Garter snake still out? That's surprising. It just seems to me that that a sensible snake would have been hibernating well before this. They do have a hibernaculum there on the campus at Long Lake, and it is amazing that those snakes gather there. Snakes do gather in groups and spend the winter sort of just just above the freezing temperatures, and that slows down their metabolism and allows them to survive without damage through the winter, and they'll be out again in the spring. The wood frog that they found hopping around in the woods, my word, I assume they found that one on Monday. You would think that any self-respecting wood frog would have tunneled down into the leaf litter and begun to put itself to sleep. This time of year, if the animals that are going to spend the winter like the wood frog in the leaf litter, if they get enough of a start on it and they cool down slowly enough, they can do so without damaging their tissue. And then they'll just be frozen through the winter. And in the spring, they'll give a little shake and everything will start back up again, which is pretty astonishing when you stop to think about it. Our next report comes from Chad Caddett's junior high class or middle school, I guess they call it now, at Little Falls Middle School.
This is Brietta
and Peyton
reporting from Little Falls Middle School. This is our photology report for the week of November 30th.
Prior to the snow, we had sightings of a woolly bear, caterpillar, and sow bugs, and the classmates still found violets blooming in their yard.
We did see small groups of robins hanging around Little Falls.
Mr. Caddett's had an opossum snooping around his yard and under his bird feeder after sundown and had a hard time getting it to leave as he didn't want his dog messing with it.
Winter arrived as we received 7+ inches of snow on the 25th, and the snow and cold weather have completely changed our environment.
One fun change with the new snow is the ability to see all the different animal tracks around our homes. The most common are the cottontail rabbits, squirrels, mice, and voles.
Those same deer, mice, and meadow voles have been appearing in our homes more frequently this past week.
The bird feeders have had a constant activity with groups of chickadees, nuthatches, downy woodpeckers, and juncos being the largest visitors.
There was a large group of cedar waxwings that arrived on Thanksgiving Day.
There was a sighting of a short-tailed shrew. It was originally thought to be a vole, but a closer look at the pictures helped identify it.
An easy sighting this time of year are some fruits of the sumac. We learned that you can make a drink similar to lemonade from it.
One observation that raised some questions was this. All fall, there have been pairs or family groups of cardinals coming to Mr. Caddis's feeder. This past week, there has only been a single female. Do they split up in winter? Is this a young bird? Did something happen to the male it was with?
This is our report for this week. Until next week, keep exploring, keep discovering, and keep connecting with the great outdoors.
Thank you, kids. Nice report, as always. That was Brianna and Peyton, Little Falls Middle School. Lots of interesting things. First of all, an opossum hanging out in Mr. Caddis's yard. They are, Little Falls has got to be, still, it's in the St. Cloud area, so it's 100, 110 miles south of here, and that appears to be the line. There is a line beyond which opossums will not or should not go, and that appears to be kind of the northern edge of their range. I don't hear or see many reports of opossums this far north. Still some robins hanging around. I haven't seen a robin up here in probably 3 weeks, but I'd have to look back in my notes to find out for sure. It's not unusual. I have many reports of robins in December in the Grand Rapids area, but they're definitely on their way south for the most part. There's always one or two that think that they can winter it over up here in sunny northern Minnesota, but for the most part, most of them have better sense and go south. They're right about the snow and and how it puts all kinds of tracks out there for everybody to check out. It's very cool to look at all the little tracks on the ground. If you see a set of tiny tracks with a line in between them, it's probably a mouse because the mice drag their tails. So check those out. Short-tailed shrew. If you look at the shrew compared to a vole, the shrew has a much more elongated, pointed snout and some definite whiskers that stick out. Neither the shrew nor the vole is going to show much in the way of ears, even though they have them. They're simply covered with fur. So if you get the chance, why, check them all out. And we'll be talking about those and other things coming up on the Phenology Show in about 25 minutes or so.
We did get a text that came in yesterday, John. It said a message for John and his Phenology Show. We have evening and pine grosbeaks both this year in Balsam Township. Just showed up this week. That's from Bruce Larson, who says he enjoys your show every Tuesday morning.
Wow, Bruce, why don't you invite me over to your house and I'll come and look at some of those grosbeaks.
He's not kidding, and you don't have to worry. He's very lovely.
I don't eat much.
Yeah, lovely man.
That is cool. I have not seen any grosbeaks this fall, not evening, not pine. I would hope to see both, but it's been a while. I mean, I did have some evening grosbeaks last year, and 2 years ago I had a flock come and stay about a week or two, but not like the old days when I used to have 50 of them and they'd spend the winter just hanging out right in my yard. So I guess I should be grateful, because in those days, 50 pounds of sunflower seeds was $5, and today 40 pounds of sunflower seeds is $20. So they would eat me out of house and home pretty fast.
So we had another call message that came in on SpeakPipe. That's a messaging service we use for the Season Watch podcast. It's been really fun to have people send us questions or stories. And it's along the same lines, the theme of being detectives this time of year and watching the tracks. We heard from Julie.
Hi, Heidi and Charlie. Thanks so much for your podcast. I really enjoy it. I was for a walk this morning in the new fallen snow and saw what I thought was the single register track from a fox, but the paw prints were quite large, and it made me wonder if there's another animal that has a single register track that's not a fox, that's bigger than a fox. So I'd love to hear your thoughts about that, and just love your show in general. Thanks. Bye.
Well, thank you, Julie, and thanks for your compliments on the show. I owe that all to Heidi and Charlie. They're the ones doing the work there. And it is a great show. You want to check it out. It's our Season Watch podcast. It's available wherever you get podcasts.